Atlantic Threads. Atlantic Threads is an initiative led by Pivot in partnership with African Artists Foundation, Dig Where You Stand, and Cité Internationale des Arts in Paris. This project, Prologue, was supported by the Embassy of France in Brazil and the Institut Français in the framework of the Brazil-France season 2025. The artists were welcomed in Paris as part of the Institut Français and Cité Internationale des Arts residency program. Conversation 1. Gabriela de Matos and Ulufemi Hinson-Yovu. Conversation 3. Annelise Agosa. Annelise Agosa is an Abidjan and London-based designer whose practice spans art, architecture, and design. Rooted in the complex relationship between culture and space, Annelise's practice is focused on bridging the gap between past and future within and around the African context. Particularly influenced by the geocultural landscape of West Africa, the Sahel, Central Sahara, and their material and oral traditions, her practice explores cosmologies and mythologies, identities and cultural practices, by conceptualizing hybrid visual worlds through form, texture, and movement. Influenced by her upbringing in multiple West African countries and her education in the West, Annelise's body of work explores the parallels and in-betweenness of cultures, identities, and their visual markers. Zindi Sissoko is a curator, cultural producer, and writer with a specific focus on anti-colonial, social, and political practices within the arts and culture. Her work is nurtured by the urgency to broaden and disseminate knowledge and artistic production from systematically racialized and marginalized perspectives. She is a curator at the Wellcome Collection in London and co-curated the French Pavilion at the 60th edition of the Venice Biennial in 2024. In this conversation with Zindi Sissoko, Annelise Agosa discusses her interest in the study of natural forms and the way in which materials and their transformation carry real and potential stories.
Thank you so much for the few of you that have stayed for this second part of the conversation. I'm in conversation with Annelise Agosa, and we will talk very much through her practice, her research, but also bringing it back to the context of the project as well. And I'm Zindi Sissoko, a curator based in the UK but born in France, and I'm part of this project as well in terms of kind of being a curator of the program, of a coordinator, a multitasker in that context as well. And Annelise, if you want to say a few words, or we can dive immediately into you. Yes, okay, let's dive. So you have formed yourself in architecture and design studies, and your research dives into the mapping of culture and knowledge from West Africa to the Middle East, and specifically Bahrain, where you have lived also for a few months, and through the Sahara and the Sahel deserts. And from an architectural point of view, there are two regions with a predominant arid environments, deserts, of course, informed by the natural ecosystems, but also where the construction of city was born out of these environmental conditions as well, lifestyles and cultures. And
There are crucial historical and contemporary crossovers in terms of models of city development today. So really thinking through some of the interests that you have in observing, in living, in really thinking about the kind of contemporary African city, what does that mean even, or the context of their development today that are clashing with their indigenous histories as well. And these tensions influence your way of working in many different senses as well. And there are also multiple layers of their histories of those places, or at least those different connections that you're making between the two regions, from tropical modernism in West Africa to the presence of concrete cities growing like mushrooms in the Middle East. And again, this relation to the concrete and the material was something that Olivier Ossi also brought up in the context of the formation of places, the material that are very much driving those ideas and driving also those movements, those kind of political movements, social movements, etc., which was in the case of your visit in Le Havre as part of the project. But moving away and going back into the spaces in which you are connecting and connected, they are also historically mostly the product of foreign designers that were imagining and also building the tropical modern movements. And there are questions around the ownership, there are questions around agency of the structures that are a part of the urban and rural landscapes, again, in those two different places, you know, not necessarily thinking about them as a kind of monolithic idea of Africa, West Africa, and the Middle East region, but really thinking about the sort of mapping of ideas, the mapping of, again, political, social, cultural connections that they hold, and that really feeds your practice as well more broadly. And again, this notion of time is a way that we understand those phenomena, those relationship, but they're also the structures that provide the visual evidence of those developments. And today, wherever we live, we are surrounded by the ghosts and the remnants of those different architectures, and in some ways, quite loosely, in the context of your practice, but also in the context of the program, we've looked at some of those kind of connections, you know, whether it's the presence again of the Oscar Niemeyer architecture here in Paris or in the context of Le Havre once again. And these really, at least the kind of legacy of those architectures, allows us also to think about how do we create, you know, our own new languages in terms of the architecture, in terms of the design and the material cultures today that connects again to those histories. And what is your own language in these fields and the ones that formed you, I mean, that sector that formed you, but also that continues to inform your practice and the ways in which you understand that relationship between space and cultures, so between those two regions, but more broadly as concepts as well.
So of course, there is a lot of layers, but I think I want to start first by saying that actually I always knew that I wanted to become an architect since I was like 7 years old, and I always said that I would do that with my life. And then I guess in my late teens, I developed a very strong interest for politics, and I was hesitating for some time, should I continue with architecture or go with politics, and also simultaneously kind of discovered a very strong interest for cinema as well. So this, for me, the first film that I saw that really, like this kind of, you know, I think probably everybody has like one body of work that really marked their kind of, the trajectory of their practice, and for me was a film called Stalker, by Park Chan-wook, who's a Korean director. And it's a thriller movie. It's going to make sense. It's a thriller movie. And actually, I was really marked by this film because of his use of objects and the way he was filming and telling the story through objects. And there was a lot of hidden meanings through these little objects that he was showing throughout the movie, and you would understand at the end why the, what they meant. I didn't really know why I loved that so much, but I really did. And in a way, I actually focused most of my studies doing research. And I was trying to establish a framework within which I would create and design, because I wanted to be able to design beyond just designing for design's sake. And around, I guess, between my bachelor and my master's, I developed this interest for the third space. What does it mean to exist in an in-between? And what happens actually when two cultures come into contact and create something else, and how we actually all today probably the product of the meeting of, you know, multiple cultures in one way or another, because we are not untouched in any way. And I don't believe in the concept of cultural purity. I think it doesn't exist, and I think it has never existed. By cultural purity, I mean that no culture is pure, no culture has formed itself in, can you say autarcy in English? No? Like in its own, like on its own. No culture is free of influence from another culture, from input from something else. Like, yeah, like basically all cultures kind of contaminate each other, right? So this idea, you know, for example, today we see a lot, oh my God, we have to go back to this time where it was purely this thing, and it has never been. There was always an influence from something else that created a cultural practice that, you know, then became kind of diluted into something else and widely accepted as being part of this culture. And we can go on and on about this, you know, the concepts of cultural appropriation and things like that. It's like, when is actually, obviously it depends on who is doing it and in which context. But it's important to say that. But I think, you know, in between, obviously I speak kind of exclusively almost about the Global South, because I also think that it's important. You know, when we talk about concepts of futurity and cultural production, I think a lot of it, especially when it concerns African futures, is coming from diasporic voices. Everybody has a lot to say. It's important for everybody to have a voice, but I think that it's also important to focus on what is happening or has been happening on the continent. And this is why my research focuses, or my interests focuses mostly on migratory flows through the Sahara, through the continent, how they have, you know, how these migratory flows have contributed to cultural production on the continent, and how actually I don't really believe in this idea of this cultural, this kind of complete cultural fracture between North Africa and the rest of the continent. It doesn't exist. There have always been, you know, contacts between these two parts of the continent. I mean, there are not two parts, there are multiple, but you understand what I mean. And so to go back to the idea of the cinema, so yes, actually what got me... So I like to say that in a way, kind of cinema got me back to architecture, because I was going, doing all of this research, trying to find this framework, and then, you know, kind of going back, diving into cinema and kind of understanding how you construct a story through objects kind of made me want to design through storytelling. The idea that I can tell a story through design. Yeah, so...
And there are so many different forms of outcomes, you know, of kind of material cultures that you create out of that research, out of those influences of cinema, more specifically, that you actually named before, those immaterial monuments, which I thought was really interesting, the ways in which you really framed cinema as a kind of architectural practice as well, are kind of borrowing from that aesthetic or that, you know, the moving image as something that's therefore was playing with this idea of objects that then influenced and informed the way in which you think and even the processes around materializing, you know, that research. So there's many different materials, you know, in the environments in which you spend time that allows to, you know, nourish that. And going back again to architecture, even though your practice also kind of moves away in a sense from the building, you know, as the, again, the monolithic aspect of it, it's
translated in many different senses. And I remember you mentioning about specifically the Hôtel Ivoire in Abidjan. That is a place that you absolutely love and that really also, once again, influenced a lot of the thinking and the ways in which you feel in a space. And another example was also, you have to remind me the name of the architect in Le Havre. You visited a flat there.
Auguste Perret.
That's it. And this was part of your visit. And again, some of the details of those, of that space, you know, the kind of life in that space that were, again, the remnants of a life, of a thinker, of a space maker, of a life in that apartment, again, influenced the way in which you look at the details of that place. And something that I want everyone to know is that you make really beautiful kind of shapes and usage of materials once again, or like a starting point of a kind of symbol, like a cultural symbol, such as the hibiscus flower, or for example, the crystallization of salt in the desert is another kind of body of work, you know, that informs, you know, the making of objects again. And we can think about objects in many different senses, or archival photographs from your own family as well, the ways in which those materials connect with your material research mapping, therefore, and they live and somehow are a part of it, in your own words, of what you mentioned, also this in-betweenness of culture, the hibiscus flower borrowing from many different contexts, the crystallization of salt being another one as a kind of aesthetic also power that you reuse in how you think.
Yes. Yes, thank you for this question. Also, I do want to clarify that I'm still interested in architecture and I do still want to design in that sense, but I think it's important for me to start from where I'm starting now. But yes, for me, the focus on these textures is really important because it kind of symbolizes these, obviously the space in the way it's been occupied. It's kind of, so kind of going back a little bit, why I became also interested in this space is because for me, it's probably the space where it's the most difficult and maybe impossible to enforce, you know, national borders. It's very porous, so people move, and they have always moved, and through these movements there was a lot of trade, and yes, for example, you mentioned hibiscus. When I spent time in the Middle East, I realized that culturally they also consumed hibiscus, and I found it really interesting because, of course, for us in West Africa, it's, you know, very widely consumed. I also learned, because I live in London, through some North African friends of mine, that they also consume it culturally, and that East Africa, they also consume it, and of course in the Caribbean as well. So it kind of became for me the symbol of this, you know, I guess like Olivier was saying, transplantation, you know, it's kind of like moves, and then it becomes absorbed into the culture, and it's kind of part of the local culture and believed to be from there, but it obviously has, you know, been, like, it's almost a contamination of this culture by something that came out from elsewhere. But obviously with time is now from there too. So it kind of has become indigenous as well. In the context of the trade of salt, so like in the context of this residency, I was looking at, you know, parallels between the trade of salt and the emergence of tropical modernism in West Africa and Brazil. So I was interested in how the trade of salt shaped the kind of dynamics of the economies in West Africa. I think it was from the 10th to the 18th century. And so how, you know, again, Olivier and Tigana spoke before about storytelling and fiction. And it has also been a kind of recurring topic in my work, where a lot of things we consider as reality actually started from fiction. So it was like a deliberate intention to create this reality. So it started as a story. We want to create this story, and then structures were put into place to make that story a reality. Then with time, it became part of this reality, right? So actually the trade of salt, it also started from a fiction that, you know, Saharan salt was superior to tropical salt. And so this is why West African tribes, kingdoms, would trade salt for gold, almost weight for weight, because it was the most valuable commodity that they could have to preserve their food because they believed it was superior to the salt that they found in their own countries, in their own climate landscapes. And similarly, of course, in the post-independence period from the 60s through to the 80s and the early 90s, in West Africa, of course, it was earlier in Brazil. Tropical modernism played a very, very important role in the shaping of the national identities. They would commission, you know, multiple architects to create and project this idea of a utopia of what, how they wanted the countries to be perceived. And there is the question of agency. And actually, initially, when I found out about this, that most of these buildings were not designed by nationals, I was like, wow, we didn't even have that much agency in the creation of the stories of what we wanted our countries to be. But actually, with time, I think my mind changed about it, because when I started going deeper into it and looking at the work, the other work that these architects had produced was so different from what they had actually done there in those countries. And it's so evident to me that they took so much inspiration from indigenous formal languages, color palettes, that everything about it today for me feels African. It is part of our, you know, architectural heritage. So of course there's the question of who did it, but they were also commissioned by, you know, the head of state. Of course there is also the question of, you know, the kind of one person dictating a reality for everyone else. But there is also agency in the way that those spaces are used and the memories that are formed through those spaces. This is where the research that I've been doing in archiving my personal family photographs from Abidjan in the post-independence period, and the stories that you grew up hearing of the people who actually have experienced and lived through these spaces, that actually, you know, it's a different perspective of understanding that these spaces were reappropriated in a way, right? But then there's also the question, was this exercise successful? Not really today. As for modernism in the Middle East, honestly, I'm not that knowledgeable about the modern architecture. But for me, it's more about, I think my interest in the similarities is more about the similarity in the indigenous mythologies and in like indigenous rituals, in the way the stories are told, what kind of music is played, what kind of instruments are used, and these kind of things that link. And of course, even with modernity and, you know, globalization, our ways of like experiencing and perceiving the world are impacted by our traditional kind of cultures.
And I think I like to think about the new terms in order to describe the renewal of practices that were long inscribed, you know, within those kind of more rigid disciplines. You know, we talk about architecture, you talk about the kind of foreign kind of appropriation or reappropriation of spaces through those creation, those buildings, those, you know, those vessels, those structures, really. And for example, the term research here in your practice, you know, reminds me of this idea of the archaeology, you know, archaeology as a discipline itself, but to be rethought as, you know, something that becomes research, you know, the kind of digging of histories that are not necessarily connected yet. They are floating, depending, to be connected, found, where your materials are immaterial production also, you know, those oral traditions, those sounds, the kind of music, the instrument that you're looking at, the languages are the outcomes of these environmental, historical, cultural intersections in time and space. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what captures your attention, you know, in those different stories, those different, the histories that take center stage, really, in the selection of, what draws your attention, just to be simple.
So I like to say that I'm dedicated to beauty. So I think beauty is what really captivates my attention. I think I kind of see if I like something first, and if I like it, then I kind of try to look more into what is behind it. And actually, so if I take one of my projects was about doors, wooden sculpted doors, or the ways that habitations have been traditionally decorated from West Africa to the Middle East. And it started from a trip to Morocco, actually, where I was spending some time in the Medina and I saw these beautiful doors. And I was going into this shop and they were selling these traditional Moroccan doors. And they also had loads of doors from West Africa as well. And actually, I found them really beautiful, but I also started to wonder how come we are both practicing this craft. And I started to wonder what is behind the symbols that are carved, what do they mean? And the common thread that I found from all these cultures, well, actually, it just started from an observation. So usually it just starts from a little bit of an obsession, and I'll be like, wow, this is so beautiful, and I'll be collecting all of these things. And then I went to Bahrain, and then I went to Sharjah, and then I found these doors again there, and I was like, wow, that's crazy. They also have these really beautiful wooden doors here. So then I started taking pictures of them and then having conversations with my friends. And I understood that actually the style that they had in the Gulf was a mix between Zanzibari style, so traditional doors from Zanzibar, and influences from South Asian cultures that are very present in the Gulf states, and of course the presence of religion. So for example, they would carve quotes from the Quran or du'as, which are like prayers or poems, on their doors. So it can be to protect or to wish, you know, good things on the inhabitants of the house. And there's, you know, also influence from, you know, Iran, floral style, stuff like that. So I thought it was really interesting that the door as an artifact is a testament to these kind of cultural encounters. And then even in the African continent as well, the doors, everything that was crafted on the, that was carved on the doors were, you know, mythologies. And they represented, you know, some kind of threshold to protect this kind of other thing that you are stepping into, and that it basically was a representation of the belief systems of the people that were making these doors, but that they all had an understanding of space and what a door represents. So I thought that was really cool.
Thank you, Annelise. I mean, you talk a lot about objects, you know, you talk a lot about the, again, the observations, the details that you, you know, point at in those different spaces that you navigate in. And you also mentioned this notion of beauty, which is such a huge, you know, concept, such a huge way to understand, you know, almost like a kind of binary way to, you know, consider things, you know, what is beautiful, what is not. And what was interesting also before is that you talked about this notion of sensuality also in the ways in which shapes are, in the ways in which you yourself also play with that, you know. Can you say a little bit more about this, yeah, this kind of sensual, like,
yes.
Yeah, kind of intimate part of the working from the materials, working from that object.
Yes.
And then maybe we can talk more about how you work with the immaterial aspects,
yeah,
of your practice as well.
Yes, so I'm, so like the textures that I work with, of course, like I'm, you know, in a similar way, really drawn to beautiful textures. There are also things that I collect. And then I'll be working from these kind of observations. But also in my work, I'm trying to kind of, like talking about this idea of storytelling and kind of telling a story of the future, but also by looking at the past, which, you know, goes back to what you were talking about with archaeology. So I'm always starting, the research that I'm doing is a starting point always for design for me. So I start by researching and kind of digging and looking at all of these things, and I design from this. So wanting to tell this story, initially I was creating objects that were almost exclusively kind of taking into, like, drawing from the inspiration of the textures of this space of the Sahara. And then I guess, like, going back to Abidjan and Lomé and Cotonou and spending time there and kind of like experiencing again these spaces of tropical modernism and looking again at like the indigenous languages, and then going back to, you know, reading about Niemeyer's work and kind of what drove his formal language, there is really this idea of being drawn to the curve and to the sensuous quality of like a more organic formal language, which is very present in our indigenous formal, you know, languages of craftsmanship. And then, of course, for me, it's also about creating beauty. So all of these objects are functional, but it's about creating beauty, putting beauty out into the world. And I think there is something really political about beauty. I think beauty is inherently political. And being able to create beauty from the cultures that I'm looking at, I'm also kind of very intentionally not wanting to create work that fits into the visual imaginary that has been created around West Africa. And I think that is almost expected of the work that is created by someone of West African descent, or that is creating something that is inspired by West Africa. Of course, I also look at the space of the desert and the Middle East, but I could also create everything that I'm doing only looking at West Africa and still do the same things, because these practices existed there, these materials existed already. So I hope this answers your question.
Yes, and I think this is, it kind of reveals a little bit the process in which you, again, you know, map a practice, map, you know, a story, map a texture, you know, that really influences the ways in which you will craft, you know, as you say, because you use that word craftsmanship, or you inscribe yourself within that. So really thinking about the ways in which it is translated through that form. But I think what's interesting also in your practice is that you work quite comfortably, but also quite coherently with that contradiction, no? With the kind of very pure material form, but also the immaterial aspect of, is key to your practice. And really this exploration is also embedded in the sensory that you tap into, therefore memory for the people that experience it, for yourself as well. So going back to the ways in which you look at, again, you know, archival materials, you know, from your family, or actually being embedded yourself in navigating a space. And for example, you explore and connect with oral traditions also. On the development of scent in your work, you're currently developing an oil diffuser. And what are those immaterial narratives that are depicted here too? And where does your practice aim to take us also in terms of the new and common epistemologies of creative production? And according to you, what and where are they immaterial in some ways?
Well, I'm going to just follow my train of thought to answer it. I think first, departing from the story and the idea of storytelling is already making it inherently immaterial, I think, because it already starts from the intention of telling a story rather than kind of doing it and then post-rationalizing it. And then, of course, I think it's also going back to the idea of ritual, and these things, you know, exist in our cultural practices, you know, burning incense, going to, like, there is a lot of memory that is attached to scent as well. So going to visit family and burning incense and enjoying a space together, I think it's adding another layer, another dimension to the experience of space, which is really interesting for me. And I definitely, but in this case, I think it's really interesting for me that I kind of realized after I produced certain object that I had an interest towards scent, I kind of produced some work, and then I was like, oh, there is kind of a story there about scent as well. But I think what is really nice is that obviously you have the visuals and the visual, and you have the tactile, and you have the story. Not yet so much oral. Yes, Yes, oral. But you also have the olfactive, which is nice as well.
And to bring it back to the project Atlantic Threads as well, what are your future projects and around? What questions do you think the cross-research is embedded in terms of the connection around architecture and culture in Brazil or West Africa as well?
I think that the connection between West African tropical modernism and Brazilian modernism, which is also tropical, is very underexplored and underdiscussed. I think there are a lot of conversations around our indigenous links and the kind of spiritual practices. But actually, for me, it is so obvious that it is glaring in your faces, if I can say that, the similarity in the expression of this modernity that actually did not express itself in this way elsewhere, that is very much in the curves, and even in the expression of those curves, I see a lot of similarities. And Niemeyer said that he was taking inspiration from the language and geometry of the landscape. And but I do wonder if, you know, there was other things, because when I look at what has been produced in West Africa, there is geometry there, as there is also in Niemeyer's work, but there is a lot of sensuous curves as well, a lot of organic shapes as well, that is derived from, as I said, indigenous formal languages, and then abstracted into this modernism that, you know, then kind of contaminated the rest of West Africa, and today is actually probably all of Africa, and which is today, with African modernism. So I think we should be looking more into that.
Thank you, Annelise. And I think we can end here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you guys for staying.
And if you have any questions, please do let us know.
I will ask two things, perhaps, because it's two direction of things. The first one is related to your interest in the desert, which is in a way interesting in the way you make also a connection with your interest in cinema. Another thing, there is something that is for me very important in that kind of landscape that or territory the desert is. It's a kind of dynamic landscape that is changing and moving. So it's the first idea I've got about the desert, not as an empty space, as you say, but a space where a lot of things happening. But it's also a kind of manual landscape that is always changing and transforming itself. And so I was wondering if that would be an influence for you also, reflecting about the idea of, you know, animation in a sense of animism, in a sense how something that is made for that kind of manual matter could be animate.
Yes. Actually, I love this question. Thank you. Yes, so actually when I started to look into this space and the ideologies and the kind of writings and what was coming out from people who actually lived or came from there, I discovered the work of poet and writer Ibrahim Alkoni, which I really recommend. His work is very beautiful. And he talked about the kind of spirituality that happens in the desert. But initially, he actually starts by talking. He says that in the beginning of the world, the human community was separated into two tribes. And there was the settled tribe, who then went on to develop, you know, capitalism. And there was the nomadic tribe, who, you know, whose aim was to never settle, was to always be on the move. And it was all about, you know, being in this constant state of movement forced you to, you know, you could not have private property, kind of, you're always, it's a different conception of ownership and a different conception of the world and your place within the world. And this is also reflected in their mythology, in the way that they see their place in relation to animals. And then in relation to like how they kind of you know, inhabit the space of the desert. But he said something which I found really interesting, and he said that in the desert you face death, and that, you know, it's life-changing, that it really forces you to step into this other level of spirituality. But what you said about this space that is in constant movement, I think what it does is that it actually really forces us to think about a different conception of space. What does it mean to design a space? Maybe an object is a space. You know, an object that helps you navigate this space can become a form of architecture as well. So I think that's also really interesting. You said you had another question, no?
So, I mean, of course, we had lots of conversations, I mean, since 3 months now. And I kind of liked the way you put that you take inspiration. And the first fact that you said that there is no such thing as culture purity, which is quite interesting to put it out there. That's the first step. And then the second thing, yesterday we spoke about how you grew up between different places and your family settings, and then finally how you mentioned that you are trying, being inspired by places like the desert, etc. You are not trying to come up with design that are, you know, awaited from a typical West African perspective. And actually it's quite interesting because maybe because of where I grew up in Cotonou, comparing to Abidjan, which was a city that, with Oufoué, as you mentioned, with all of the input of everybody, had decided a visual architectural future that translated into not only architecture, but also film and music, etc., with that mixity of different things. And then me growing up in a culture, in a country like Benin, where I grew up most of my life, where there was that lack of gesture, which now makes me trying to reclaim not just not architecture necessarily in a final shape, but more the principle, the epistemology, but also the ontology and the ipseity, the essence of what West African architecture was in different time and its evolution. And I am very aware that I don't want to also put out, like, you know, weighted forms, but at the same time, for me, there's a need to take that road. But at the same time, I am also very much interested into, like, Japanese architecture. And sometimes I designed something and somebody said, "You're Japanese temple." And then I didn't know what to make of it then, yeah. Because I was like, okay, do I want my architecture to be a Japanese temple, or do I want it to be a West African temple? But at the same time, yesterday, I'm rambling a little bit, but it's okay. Yesterday, I had this Afro-Brazilian student that I actually met yesterday and today, and then I showed her the buildings, and because it was pitch roof, she said it was indigenous. And then I told her, but pitch roof is universal. We use pitch roof in West Africa because of the rain, high pitch, and they use pitch roof in Europe because of the snow. But pitch roof is universal. And then, so this is why in my practice, I try to attach to climate and societies rather than image and symbols to find the meaning into how I want to design. So I just wanted to share that point of view because I also want to inscribe my architecture into a tradition of building that existed, but at the same time make it contemporary. So anyway, it's just, I had to say it because it's quite interesting that we have different approach, but at the same time, they are, I don't know, similar, yes. But also...
Actually, I think that these things, for me, they are not mutually exclusive, because obviously a lot of the things that I look at is, you know, indigenous to West Africa. I think, for me, I, of course, like you said, I have a lot of different influences, and I think it would be dishonest of me to pretend that I don't. So I think that in the work that I do, I also feel that I can't be the voice. I can't say that, oh, I'm doing Ivorian, fully Ivorian this. I think it would be dishonest, and I think it would, I think that there's someone else who can do it better than me, and I think it would, it's still very valuable, but I don't think that it, like I said, it wouldn't be honest. But I think it's also really important to look like, you know, I also consider things like climate, like, for example, what I found really interesting about the practice that I went to work for in Bahrain was I was interested in how are they working with the local climate conditions, which is heat, extreme heat, and sand and dust. And actually I was, you know, one thing that I left out in all of this talk about why I became interested in the space of the desert was also in a context of active desertification of West Africa, what could be a future kind of, you know, formal language that, in my opinion, is inevitable, because the expansion of the desert pushes the current people of the Sahel further down, the current people of the Sahara further down, and these cultural mixings is only a matter of time. So I'm kind of looking at what could happen if these formal languages came into contact and gave a babe had a baby. And so, yeah, it's obviously, you know, it's very important to also look at climate, and looking at obviously indigenous and what has been done before is very important to come up with solutions for that. So for me, actually, I was having a conversation with Cindy earlier today about this, that this idea of futurity for me is like a loop, because, you know, you're obviously in the present, but you're always going back to the past. How were they doing that? Okay, cool. They were, you know, using this kind of indigenous technology, and then kind of thinking through that, what is going to happen, basically. So then you're kind of always working through this loop of circularity. And so, yes, I think it's really cool what you're doing as well.
And so complementary as well. As you said, I think, Femi, it's really thinking about how you have totally different approaches, but that join themselves in the ways that you reinvent that relationship with spaces, that experience with spaces, physical, non-physical experiences as well. Is there any other question? Okay, go for the second.
So I think the second one is related to cinema. Okay. As you know, I'm quite familiar with cinema. I spent decades of producing film, not only being interested in. And I'm quite interested in the relationship that could be, or at least the conversation can be built in between perhaps the two conversations we had today. In between the movement on the relation, even the tense relation between presence and projection. Because I do think, I work a lot in cinema, and for me, the limit of the cinema was also related to the limit of modernism, of a thought based on projection. Brazilian modernism is a political project of producing an image of what Brazil will be for the rest of the world. Indeed, okay, this is our architecture. And for the moment of the independence, as you know, there was the aim of producing an image of what would be for the rest of the world, the image of you, modernity. And we know that we can understand that. It's a kind of zero point, that a political decision. In both instances, there are political decisions of create a kind of zero at some point. Says, okay, this is what we are now for the future. And of course, it's very related to the idea of projection, projecting an image. And you see, when we look also on your collection of image of architecture as an image, I've been already marked by that. Because most of the time, people, architects are always thinking, not all, but some of them are thinking about the use of architecture. But you know, you quote Niemeyer, that is really clearly stuck in the idea of the architecture as an image, as a kind of performative image, and a form of beauty, as you say, as a visual beauty. Because it's again a question with beauty. What is beauty? Is it visual beauty or is it beauty in a rational world? And myself, I did a kind of movement that is in certain way going, moving. I don't know how to qualify that because it's not moving back indeed. It's moving forward. I don't know if it's back and forward. But in a way, trying to ask another question, what could be a cinema of presence and not cinema of projection? Coming to indigenous practices of hallucination and image producing by the presence. And indeed, I make a relation in between the idea of architecture as a projection and cinema as a presence, again, in a kind of oxymoron, coming back. Is not cinema is supposed to be a projection, but what does it could be? What it could be if it relates to presence, and also what architecture is when it's related to projection. And so I think there is a movement in between, in the continent, in between that kind of two things, not only one, the desire of producing images, that also relate to storytelling, even if a part of the storytelling of Africa are not images-based, not all. They are also based on sound, on repetition, so there are also that dimension. And so, yeah, I was I'm not sure I got the precise question, but want to share with you that tension in between presence and projection inside our conversations.
Yes, I think also I really like the job.
And if you have any projection about Brazil? yes,
okay,
just...
I think I will first answer Olivier's... if I have any ideas about Brazil, you mean?
Ideas for projections.
Okay, I think first I will go from what Olivier said, which actually I think is really interesting you said that, because actually in this project that I did, so I started looking at tropical modernism actually in 2020, from 2020 to 2021. And I actually started by looking at cinema again. I started by looking at cinema, and I was interested in kind of putting the cinema against the building. So it was, like you said, the construction of these buildings as monuments and monuments as well was a very deliberate and very intentional decision from these new countries. And they were simultaneously also producing books. They were producing books that they were publishing, and that was about their countries. They would say, this is our country, this is who we are, this is who our president is, this is who our tribes are, this is what our landscapes are. And, you know, this is what we do. These are our natural kind of resources. And then, simultaneously to this image, like you said, that they were projecting, you had a lot, and we still talk about it today, a lot of, you know, directors from this era that were producing movies. And they were not, obviously they were very political. Today we can see them as being very political, but in the moment that they created them, they didn't necessarily have a political intention, or if it did, it was very hidden. If I take Tukibuki, for example, by Mambeti, and you were talking about the use of sound
I
and...
I think it's political.
Yeah, it's very political. But, you know, again, in the creation of those movies, they were intentionally hiding the political nature to avoid revealing it to the political leaders that they were making political movies. Mm-hmm. So they would use sound, they would use the symbols, you know, like the god Ama, or like the subversion of, you know, feminine and masculine, the repetition of sounds, the use of rituals and stuff like that in the creation of this like visual imagery.
And I think that was in a way the anti-hero figure.
Yeah, the anti-hero, and there was always this narrative of, like, you know, this character that is trying to escape to Europe. What does it mean? Because there is the story that obviously the country is projecting of this utopia and these crazy buildings that they are, you know, building, and this is what life is, but, you know, the character always is trying to escape. So it kind of creates an interesting duality between what is a monument also, you know, for me these are also immaterial monuments. So it is kind of like, where is the creation of the monument coming from? but also, like I was saying earlier, a monument that is created or that is commissioned by, you know, the state cannot control, cannot, you know, the use of this space cannot be controlled. And I think contrary, actually, to Niemeyer's buildings, where I would say, like, the beauty is, like, really what takes center stage and the function. I mean, I have not, like, inhabited so many of his buildings. But I think that in West Africa, or at least in Ivory Coast specifically, I think it was a much more successful exercise because I think the actual experience of this space is much more enjoyable and pleasant. Yeah, but then of course, like I said, it's, you know, what, how did the people reappropriate those spaces? I think it's something really interesting about, you know, there can be a building that represents something and then you can make a film in this same space and create something else. Yeah, and to answer Tigana's question, do I have any projections about Brazil? Not really. I don't know. I think that I don't know enough about Brazil to have projections. I think now, like, something that I try to do when I want to go somewhere, or like I'm planning to go somewhere, or I try to not have any preconceived ideas about it so that I can have a more neutral experience. Obviously, it can never be completely neutral, but.
Just after this experience of Atlantic Threads, that's why I asked
okay.
about this.
Yeah, I think, like I was saying before, I think there are many more links beyond what has been predominantly studied and discussed. And I think for me, obviously there are questions of coloniality and how that links us, but I think what is really interesting for me is, like, how do these kind of remnants of cultural links exist today in the modern, you know, life.
And I think maybe going back to what Olivier and Tigana were mentioning earlier, it's also what are the links that we want to make in relation to that space, you know, in relation to this kind of semi-fictional but super real also connection of France, Brazil, and, you know, West Africa as this kind of, again, big monolithic region. Is like, do we imagine something? Do we create? Do we fictionalize, in fact, what those connections could be today? Or do we actually look from things that we know are present, whether they are in architectural matters, in languages, in, you know, belief, in cultural practices that are very much embedded in the ways in which we live every day, but also that we know of? And I think this kind of fiction almost, or this fiction through maybe making something that is very tangible or architectural, or again, a whole area of languages. And again, this is to be deconstructed in methodologies, in practices, et cetera, et cetera. But do we just invent something of also the kind of coming together of, as you framed it very well and very clearly explained it, you know, this kind of institutional framework that also brings us together in thinking together what this space should be about or what it is about. And I think this is also, you know, this kind of poisoned gift of, you know, thinking and giving in us that opportunity to, you know, to rethink that space, and whether this will be in Bahia, in Brazil, in, you know, Ivory Coast, Benin, etc. What do we make also the context of France and Paris that's don't necessarily have those very tangible, direct evidence of those histories potentially too, or that coming together here. So what do we make out of that? How do we actually project back into, you know, those frames and the kind of counter-narratives that we manage to think about, you know, as a collective, as a... that is embedded within each of our individual practices as well. What do we make? What do we invent? Next chapter.
This.
Yes.
Just quickly going back to cinema, there was this very beautiful movie, film, not a movie, Borom Saret, Ousmane Samben. And I also recently watched La Noire 2, but Borom Saret was when we mentioned tropical modernism and also the creation of the city and also the political lens through which the director chose to narrate the story. And it's actually quite interesting when you kept mentioning that arcade cinema was something that often brought you back to architecture. And for me, I recently discovered Borom Saret, and it was just very beautiful the way it was literally the exhibition that I created, which was translating from vernacular to contemporary architecture. That was literally what the movie was doing, just like coming from the suburbs to the plateau in Dakar, and then showing different layers of the culture and the people, and also the segregation of the plateau and its state nowadays. And then also just to also mention something, I also have another friend, probably you know her, Nana, who actually got interested in tropical modernism because she was watching Half of a Yellow Sun from Chimamanda, and then she was looking at the building where they were living, and she was looking at the claustra, and then that's how she started being interested in tropical modernism. It's actually very funny because when I saw that movie, I also just like froze on that building and then like start researching that building. So just the thought of also how cinema helps building us as architects and become also an archive, that a visual archive of the work we're doing and the work that we keep doing. Yeah, so just thank
exactly.
You.
Also, I wanted to say actually in link with something that Olivier said earlier about our traditional modes of historicizing cultures, actually why I also came back to cinema is that cinema for me, it was like I was kind of thinking about cinema as a form of museum, so kind of like a form of museum that is more derived from our traditional oral history, or oral practice of historicizing culture.
I'd like to add just something about the question you opened. No, because you opened that question about what do we do now, and so we let that it floating. And just perhaps to reconnect several conversations, including the ones we had last week with Gabi and Olifemi. I would say, I think, what we do is not only, to relate also to Tigana, intentional things, matter and spirit are doing things through us too. And I just take it for a kind of example, the conversation we have with Hanley's, which is very focused on beauty, as I'm very focused on politics. And indeed, she's very focused on politics and very focused on beauty. But everything you refuse to be related to is haunting you. I was very interested in the fact that you try in certain way to resist to something, as we all do. It's not only you, but the idea of a resistance to say, "Oh, I don't want to enter in that thing," you know, Olivier. Yeah, but you are in. You are in through another way. Because I think when you're creating an assembly, we're not only coming with our intention of doing something. Things are doing else, our family, ancestors are speaking through us. And so suddenly something appears that is not something that is an addition of intentions. This is also a kind of anthropic result. What is really, so what can we do is also accept that if even a part of our refusal is even dominates, but things that suddenly achieve to be there despite our refuse, including the spectrum of the Western modernity.
Before Freud.
Yeah. Now, just to say that the idea of what we do seems to be very intentional, and I would just to bring back the idea of something happening also in anthropic way.
I agree. I think completely with you. And that's, I think, actually, a lot of time, you know, if I want to just speak very briefly about beauty for a moment, when I'm interested in something, obviously I find it beautiful, but I don't know why. And then I'll be collecting things for, like, you know, maybe 1 month, 2 months, 1 year. And then in 1 year, I'll understand why, maybe even longer, I'll understand why I was interested in this thing in the first place, because it all makes sense. But I think in response to what you're saying about politics and being political or not, I think that it's not possible to not be political. I think that, you know, I was having this conversation with my sister a few days ago, and also with Cindy today, about how probably the most radical thing that you can do as a black person is to just exist. And I think that there is, as a black woman, everything that I do is already political. And I think, you know, this is why I talk about the political nature of creating beauty and creating what I create. This, like, you know, kind of refusing to create something that might be expected of me. And I think that all of these things are already political in themselves, and that I don't have to say that it's political, that I don't have to talk about the political nature of it, because it already is. And I think that also it is draining and exhausting to talk about political things to people that are not receptive to it. So I choose who I talk about politics to, but I don't want to kind of put politics in a certain way at the center of what I do, because I feel that my existence is already over-politicized, kind of against my will. So I don't want to over-politicize it as well. But obviously we're all political, even people who say that they're not.
Perfect conclusion. Thank you so much, Annelise. Thank you for your time and generosity.
And
all of you,
Olivier,
so that
for
I'm
being
still
very
here. Thank you.
Atlantic Threads.